a lot of farmers are doing regenerative ag and they aren't getting credit for it. And frankly, you know, we need decommoditization in our agriculture system, right? We need to grow less commodity-based stuff and more high-value stuff.
Welcome to the 394th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. Spend any time checking into how farmers can get better rewarded financially for taking care of the soil, and you're likely to run into terms like value chains and supply chains. These terms are shorthand for describing the route products take from the field to the fork. Such links are pretty minimal when money changes hands at a local farmer's market or at a roadside stand. When we're talking about getting a farm's production into a grocery store or restaurant, things get a bit more complicated. In that case, a good food chain consists of productive farmers, a reliable transportation system, competent processors, and a marketing retail infrastructure that gives eaters a product they're happy with. And ideally, every participant along that chain will profit from their effort. John Strophas thinks a lot about how farmers utilizing regenerative cropping methods can take part in the food chain in a way that they benefit financially for all the effort they put into building healthy soil. John is a Minnesota farmer and owner of Field Theory Foods, a business that connects food brands to regenerative farmers. Field Theory also has its own line of branded baking mixes and other products that are available through retail outlets. John and his family have long been involved in the horse and hay business. They also have a lot of experience raising beef for direct-to-consumer sales, which has provided him invaluable insights into a part of the consumer market that values knowing where their food comes from. That kind of marketing has also sparked his entrepreneurial spirit. He initially got interested in producing high-value crops for food-grade markets after he started growing hemp as a food ingredient in 2016. One thing led to another, and the food companies he was selling to started asking about what other ingredients John could produce. So he started growing crops like sunflower, buckwheat, and oats. Today, he and a partner farm roughly 850 acres in Minnesota and Wisconsin. John has degrees in marketing and information technology and worked for several years in the field. Through that experience, he learned how to make connections through sometimes complex networks. So, besides growing ingredients himself for food companies, John also helps these businesses source their ingredients from other farmers. In a sense, he's the blacksmith that forges critical links in the food chain. Soil health is a passion of John's, and one of his chief motivations is figuring out a way that farmers can get rewarded for utilizing cover cropping, no-till, diverse rotations, and other regenerative practices. He not only feels these practices are good for the environment and the climate, but that they produce a better product for eaters. I recently stopped by John's farm near Hastings, just a mile from where the St. Croix River separates Minnesota from Wisconsin. We talked about how raising crops for the food-grade market is different than growing a raw commodity for something like livestock feed, and what farmers need to be aware of if they're going to enter this sector of the industry. John also discussed the exciting opportunities the food grade market offers for farmers who are seeking to get rewarded for regenerative practices. As he makes clear, we all need an entry point to get started. For John, growing hemp turned out to be a key gateway into the food ingredient supply chain.
If I look back, so many things that we did starting with hemp, you know, that was the hardest way to do it. You know, I didn't know anything about the food industry, right? So I had to rely on people I worked with, and we've been blessed to have some really great trading partners where I sort of pride myself on building long-lasting, meaningful relationships. And so some of those partners, or most of those partners we started back in 2016, we continue to work with today. But there's so much to learn in the food industry, food safety being, you know, one of the huge pillars of that. So when we talk about, you know, growing a crop, you know, it's It's one thing to focus on it, you know, that's going for feed production, or you know, you don't have to worry about, you know, some of the sanitary types of things. But when you get into food ingredient, you have to kind of shift your mindset a little bit. Hemp is a difficult, you know, ingredient to sell. It's more unique and very niche. And so as we expanded into other crops, you know, that sort of, you know, became easier, right? And so that was one of the reasons we wanted to diversify, because, you know, we needed more volume to support the company than what just hemp, you know, ingredient buyers were seeking.
I think it's a little bit tied in with the soil health movement, where people got interested in adopting some of these soil health practices on their farm, and then they realized there was a connection that consumers maybe made with healthy soil and healthy food, and one thing led to another a little bit. So there is, seems to be more of an interest in, if I'm going to go to the effort of putting in place some of these soil healthy practices, then maybe I'm going to also look at raising something different, because it does, building healthy soil relies on a diversity of crops. That's one of the mainstays. So, well, how about small grains or other things that can go into that food ingredient market? So it's become a popular thing to talk about, but if it was doable, everybody'd be doing it. What do you think would surprise a farmer about the food ingredients market getting into that that they may not know? And what should they kind of know before they start to maybe look into that and planning their cropping regime a little bit, maybe changing it to fit into that?
First of all, just on the soil health topic, you know, that's kind of near and dear to me. I'm actually on the executive board of Minnesota Soil Health Coalition, which I encourage, you know, listeners to check out. It's a huge value for, you know, helping explore ways to make our soil better, and a great value, lots of videos and things like, you know, Land Stewardship Project. But the connection with soil to food is becoming, or soil health to nutrient density really is where the industry focus, I think, right now is. Mm-hmm. We've had this term regenerative out here for, or, you know, quite a while, and happy to talk a lot about that. I actually first heard the term regenerative agriculture from a customer, and that was, you know, kind of upside down, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so what that means to different people. And we had that come to us when we were exploring our first sunflower production for this customer. They said, you know, can you do it regeneratively? And, you know, I was working Google to understand exactly what that was. Huh? And that was about, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. You know, first of all, it's not quite like the field of dreams. If you build it, they will come. You know, finding direct, you know, switching to food ingredient crop production versus true commodity, or, you know, what we would consider livestock feed market, that is different. And so making that switch is one thing, and then trying to work directly with a brand company for direct farm production, what we call direct trade business, you know, that's difficult, because you have a large food company, they speak in different languages, mm-hmm. than farmers, and that's okay, but somebody needs to help with that translation. And so there's a lot of farmers that have been successful working directly with food companies. I was one of those. So I've learned a lot in that time. But what we try to do is, you know, help be that bridge from the farmer to the brand. And that's the ingredient middle market, if you will, the processor, the aggregator, that function. But I think the biggest challenge is that, you know, food safety. So we have to, you know, be careful about, really careful about moisture at harvest, how we're managing the crop in the bins. Do we have insect issues? Do we have, you know, we can't have molds and, you know, other things that we might see with a little bit of corn on the side of the bin. That's no problem, because it's going to get blended in. When we're talking about parts per million or parts per billion in certain cases, most of our customers are gluten-free customers, so gluten crops. So then this plays into the regenerative side, where we have cover crops like rye, which is a fantastic entry-level cover crop. You know, it's easy, it's fantastic. And then we have some wheat growers. So if we're contracting with a grower who has, you know, uses rye or raises rye, wheat or other gluten-containing crops, you know, we have to have a little bit of a long conversation with them on how they're going to manage gluten contamination on farm, because that affects the whole supply chain. You know, when we talk about putting it in a processing plant that's gluten-free, and then certainly being able to sell that to a customer. So we want to make sure that farmers understand that risk, and then just general food safety. I mean, it is just sort of a different market from a quality perspective.
So we were talking about regenerative agriculture, and you know, that's, to me, regenerative is kind of the 2.0 of the sustainable. It was called sustainable ag for many years, and then it kind of evolved into more regenerative, which I think is a better term for kind of some of the things folks are doing, because they're not just trying to sustain what's going on, but trying to make it better a little bit and working with ecological systems, that kind of thing. Where does organics fit into that, and where does the organics market fit into something like that?
First of all, from the regenerative side, a lot of farmers are doing regenerative ag and they aren't getting credit for it. So most farms are trying to minimize soil disturbance. They're trying to have more crops in the rotation. That's kind of where we come in from a market perspective. How can we bring new crops and markets, which supports more crops in the rotation, which in turn supports better soil health. They're doing no-till. They're not maybe doing no-till everywhere, but they're trying to do no-till where it makes sense, and then they do some tillage, and then they go back to no-till. So all these things are part of these soil health principles, which are part of regenerative agriculture. The consumer, again, isn't quite getting that, right? They kind of understand the sustainability term and so forth, but really nutrient density, what they can see in the facts panel on the back of their products, that's sort of what they're keying. So the food industry is trying to figure out how we tie nutrient density into regenerative agriculture, which of course goes back to the farm. So one of the things to get credit, if you will, for the activities that are out there that farms are doing today, you know, there's carbon credit programs and there's things like that, which I'm not a huge fan of, because I think that's frankly taking advantage of the farmer in a lot of aspects and not really answering any of the questions mm-hmm. around, you know, what we're actually doing other than just purely sequestering carbon and trying to count it and trade it as a currency. So what we've done in the food company is we've started working, you know, there's certification entities out there. The non-organic space, Regenerified is one of them. Soil Climate Initiative is another one, and that's the one that we work most closely with, Soil Climate Initiative. And what their purpose in life is, they're a nonprofit entity, and their role is to help verify what farmers are doing and claiming that as regenerative, so that brands can actually make those claims with good conscience that it's true and correct. Mm-hmm. So it's a verification of essentially using that term regenerative. And what I love about Soil Climate Initiative, Regenerified is the same way, where you can get certifications and verifications for doing regenerative practices on conventional crop systems as well as organic. If we look at organic, the single most popular, I guess, or what has captured more of the consumer brand awareness is Regenerative Organic Certified. Regenerative Organic Association manages that certification platform, but it's only open to organic farmers. Getting back to the organic side of things, what I tell people is regenerative is sort of embedded a little bit more in the organic system, because you have to have crop rotation. You have to be doing cover cropping. You're doing a lot more tillage, but that's for weed control. So the more cover cropping and crop rotation you can do, the less, you know, tillage. But organic, the purists, if you will, are organics and regenerative. If they think that, you know, regenerative organic certified is the gold standard of how everybody in the world should be farming, they're talking about making, you know, 1-2% of those organic soils better. And what I like to shift the conversation to, the other 99% of the world's soils. So if we can move regenerative practices into the conventional system and capture credit and premium for that, that to me is much more impactful to the planet, really. And it should resonate more with consumers, but organic has done a great job of marketing organic foods as being better for people. And I think to some extent that's true, but we can make conventionally grown foods much better and do much better for the soil by, you know, reducing inputs, reducing chemicals and things like that, which we all want to do from a profitability perspective anyway. I do a lot of speaking engagements and talk to a lot of farmers. I'm a farmer myself. We have about 75 to 100 acres in the organic system of the 800 to 900 that we farm. So what I like to leave conventional farmers with is this thought is, you know, we're all in a struggle around the economics of farming, looking for new markets, new ways to increase profitability, and organics is another tool in the tool belt. And most farmers are intimidated with organics because they feel like, well, it takes 3 years to transition, then, you know, I don't have the labor, you know, to keep up with this, and I don't have the tools, right? That's true, maybe, but you don't have to transition your whole farm. You know, I say start with 10% of your farm production. You know, if you farm 1,000 acres, put 100 in organic. If you raise hay, that's a great way to transition. Also, you know, it's 3 years, but it's 36 months from your last prohibited input. So if you think about when's the last time you sprayed your corn or your beans, you know, it was probably in July. So July is when that clock starts ticking. So you can put it into hay for, you know, 2 years, and then you have a organic certified crop, you know, in your third year. So it happens pretty quick. And if you grow 200 bushel conventional corn, you can pretty easily grow 150 to 180, certainly your first year, organic corn, and you're talking about, you know, basically a price double. And you can rotate it in and out. You don't have to have it in organics forever. So I would encourage farms to look at that just from a commercial perspective, if nothing else.
Kind of keeping on the topic of regenerative ag and that type of thing, are we kind of, do we kind of have a perfect storm coming together here in terms of advancements that we're making in soil health and farmers very interested in these practices, and the science is starting to catch up to that, and we're starting to see some real practical applications of that, combined with consumer interests in nutrient density of food and healthy food in general and kind of knowing the source of their food. And then with entrepreneurs like yourself who are able to kind of get in that and be the go-between between those two worlds a little bit, are we in a situation, I don't want to get too excited about it, but that we maybe finally are going to be able to see farmers who are using these regenerative practices get rewarded financially for what they're doing? Because it's no doubt that it rewards us environmentally and rewards us, you know, in terms of water quality, carbon sequestration, all of that has already been a given, but it's the economic benefits, particularly maybe in the shorter term, have always been a little bit out there yet. Is this in a time when we maybe with the markets and everything that we're going to start seeing some of that really be rewarded in the marketplace?
I hope so. You know, again, I haven't been involved in, I'll say, commodity agriculture for that long relative to others. You know, so if I, you know, say 10 years versus some people have been in industry for, you know, 40, 50 years, same for the food sector. I come at it, I guess, maybe with sort of a more unique or fresh perspective because I'm not locked into that, you know, this is the way I was brought up and this is, you know, my area of focus. But just as an observer, you know, if you look at number one, we have low farm profitability. So farms are seeking something to change. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to make more money. So they're looking for ways to make more money, and you can only reduce so much on your input side. You know, I think, you know, that's a constant area of focus. People are going to continue to look at that. But that is driving people to look at regenerative ag, because they're thinking about it from a, you know, how can I just do more with less by doing something better for the soil? And once my soil is kind of on a flywheel after a couple years of getting going, you know, they can increase profitability because inputs are naturally being reduced. Crop diversity, to me, is probably one of the biggest areas that people grow things because their markets are right there. So for us, you know, we're 12 miles from two terminals. We can sell to Bunge, go right on the river, or we can sell to ADM, go right on the river. So that's pretty convenient for us, and we get, you know, a better basis. Wheat, so we have Arden Mills 9 miles away from me in Hastings, one of the the oldest flour mills. There's nobody that grows wheat around here. I've got a couple neighbors, they put 40, 60, 80 acres in. They do it for cash flow in August, and that's about it. But, you know, we kind of have a problem in our area because hitting, you know, protein levels that the mill wants. So there's truck upon truck upon truck coming from North Dakota and northern states into my little town. So the market has moved to the other states, but the processor is still here. That's fairly unique. But, you know, sugar beets is another example, trucking intensive. So that's in certain areas where there's processing, potatoes. You kind of get trapped into this, what are the few crops I can grow in that particular certain area? So that's one of the things Field Theory Foods is doing, is trying to bring these food grade markets, like, you know, sunflowers, for example, to growers who have an interest in doing that but don't have that market for, you know, in this case, sunflowers. So this is all a long way to say, yes, farms are looking for other things. Regenerative is the play to do it. And then politically, we have consumers who are much more interested in where their food comes from. And, you know, right, wrong, or otherwise, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, there is a fundamental shift now about focusing on food. You know, I think the policy debate will be had, and there will be more changes and evolution. But, you know, now we have the government seriously looking at what is in our food and how is that viewed in policy. And then that extends into USDA. And, you know, people have love-hate relationship with USDA. And I, for me, the jury's still out. But the point is that, to your point, in the perfect storm, all of these balls are sort of up in the air and being moved around. And that is generally good, because there's more opportunity to connect the supply chain when everybody's sort of talking about similar things in a maybe different viewpoint, or certainly people have bias, but there's much more opportunity to make something better. And so that's what I'm hopefully optimistic about.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you a little bit about is, if you are going to try to access that food grade market or a specialty market, as opposed to just taking the corn and beans to the elevator, one of the things that you're going to probably have to become savvy about and work with is contracts. And I find that exciting in a way, because you can get a contract and you know this is what you're going to get paid, and you know that this, they're going to take that product once you produce it, that kind of thing. But it's I'm sure there's some things you have to be very aware of if you are going to start entering that world of signing contracts and raising for a contract.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you want to plant something that you know you have a market for. You know, food ingredient production is different. And, you know, the good thing is that most companies that are seeking, you know, food grade or selling food grade ingredients are sourcing those crop ingredients, and they're offering contracts ahead. Most of the time, those are full production contracts. They're act of God clauses, so we don't have minimum and maximum caps. Some will do a base, you know, so, and most things are in pounds, but, you know, if you talk bushels or pounds, you know, 1,500 pound per acre guarantee, and then they have a right to buy the over. You know, contracts are structured in many different ways, but it is important to have the contract, you know, if you're going to explore this. The other thing is that most of these food contracts are buyer's call. So that's a different mindset for growers as well. And they have to consider that when they're looking at maybe a premium they're going to capture versus what they need from a cash flow perspective. Because, you know, you might contract your corn or soybeans in the conventional market, and you might say you contract half of them and you get them half sold, and then you store them. And, you know, if it's Christmas is coming, or, you know, ahead of the tax man, you know, you might go sell 3 or 4 truckloads of corn and raise some cash. The food grade market isn't like that. I mean, you could find spot buy opportunities for whatever you grew, but most of that is buyer's call when the processor needs it. And so that might be...
So just to go, buyer's call means they call you and say, I need it.
Yeah, they call you and they say, hey, you know, like for us, you know, we try to give 2 week heads up and say, you know, we'd like to bring in your production next. And then, you know, it's not like you load up 10 truckloads all at once. Like, it might take, you know, a week to get all your production moved, and then it's cleaned and it's processed, and then that might take a couple weeks to get the data of your cleanout report to do your settlement. So these are not like overnight transactions where, you know, anytime you need cash, you can get it. You know, it's based on, and it, you know, this is important to recognize too, it's based on someone eating something. So, you know, like, so hopefully people, you know, continue to eat more of whatever you're growing, because that's essentially your market. You know, we have to be careful too, because a lot of these brands who are seeking out these, you know, regenerative supply chains, some of them are big, but some of them are smaller too, and they're emerging brands. And so, you know, ability to pay is important too. And so what we, you know, carefully consider when we start working with our customers and then offering contracts down the way, knowing how impactful that is at the farm level. We have to make sure that, you know, we don't over contract, we don't under contract, and we have contracts structured in a way that allows us to pull that production in a time manner when we need it, and not front load it and pay storage and interest and so forth to hold that, and also quality. So, you know, if you process too much ahead, there's, you know, sort of a best buy date, a time clock where that food potentially can expire, start to lose quality after it's processed. So keeping it on farm, managing buyer's call in a timely manner, you know, that's really important. But it's really important for farmers exploring this to understand that, so that, you know, they go into things eyes wide open.
Is there an ingredient that you're running into recently that buyers are really looking for, that food companies are really looking for, that can be raised here that kind of maybe excites you a little bit, that maybe something that just is not being, because you were mentioning the, you know, wheat, for example. We've got a flour mill here right in the area, but hardly any wheat being raised. But is there any other things like that that are, it's like, oh boy, there's some real potential right there?
I don't know if maybe I'm the best judge of that, because we, you know, I'm embedded with customers who are very focused on gluten-free mm-hmm. products. So some of the, you know, maybe gluten-containing options or brands, they might have other interests. You know, definitely it's been talked a lot about, and I know we've had different conversations with other local Minnesota groups here around oats. Mm-hmm. So oats is definitely, you know, it's gluten-free. People, some of these brands are sensitive. They want to be grain-free. Well, oats is sort of one of those crops that kind of gets, it gets a sort of a pass, I guess, if you will. It's a thought about more positively. So I think that there's more oat demand out there, in especially people and brands that are in the gluten-free space. So oats is of interest right now. Buckwheat is something that we're very heavily involved with, and has been typically used as a cover crop. We've been growing buckwheat for food ingredient production for about 4 years now, and contracting for that. We contract over 1,000 acres of organic buckwheat every year. We don't actually have a conventional market for buckwheat, but our organic buckwheat market is very strong. And we go out to the, it's called the Natural Products Expo West in California, is the largest food show in the United States every March. And last year, buckwheat was one of the trends, So the top trends. And there's a couple of different brands that we work with and supply buckwheat into. So I think you're going to see that potential ingredient increase in its use and application. And it's interesting because, again, a lot of these brands are gluten-free focus. And buckwheat, even though it has wheat in the name, is not a gluten-containing crop. So, and it's a great crop to grow, by the way. It germinates quickly, can be used in a double crop system, because it's about a 65 to 70-day maturity.
And it's a beautiful crop. Boy, there's nothing like a field of buckwheat. It's just a really neat thing to see. And all the pollinators really love buckwheat. Can you give me just backing up a little bit? So, give me a rundown of what all you're raising on the farmland that you're farming.
We're heavy traditional GMO corn. I think this year we're going to explore some non-GMO corn markets. Mm-hmm. Soybeans, we raise typically alfalfa and/or orchard grass, hay production, conventionally sunflower as well. Okay. So last year we didn't raise, basically raised like 40 acres of soybeans, and we raised about 390 acres of conventional sunflowers, and that was for this food program. And, you know, that was market driven too. Like, we just didn't want to grow soybeans, you know, and we had the opportunity to grow sunflower through the foods company. We're going to be contracting more sunflowers this year too, by the way. And then in the organic space, corn, although we try to grow less corn because of the high nitrogen use, and we just don't have great organic fertilizer options right here. And then we've grown organic sunflower. So we had a lot of organic sunflower last year. We grow organic buckwheat, and then we've tried small red edible beans. And one of the main focuses, again, back to the food company, is trying to offer contracts that are multi-crops and give the grower diversity so they could grow, you know, rotation essentially for us. So we're looking for a legume, and small red edible beans seem to be, you know, the market that we think we can capture with our customers. We'd like to explore fava beans. So I would say too, back to new and emerging things, fava beans are an area of interest because it's a protein. So, you know, protein is still very in vogue, right? Yeah. And so that's dominating the food, you know, the consumer side of the market is high protein. I think we all eat plenty of protein, but brands and ingredient manufacturers are seeking new innovative proteins, and fava bean is definitely one of them. And it's great on the agronomy side because it fixes a tremendous amount of nitrogen. So fava beans would be great if we could figure out a long-term customer supply chain for that.
Roughly in a year's time, how many farmers are you kind of working with, and I guess customers on the other end? I know it's all, it varies, but do you have a rough estimate of that?
On the farm side, so spanning both sides, organic and conventional, we probably, you know, we're contracting around 1,500 to 2,000 acres on the organic side. And on the conventional side, last year we had about 2,300 acres of conventional contracts, and we're looking to potentially increase that to 4,000 this year. And then on the food ingredient side, you know, that sort of comes and goes, but we have a couple, really four large national brands that we support their supply chains. And then we have just a lot of smaller brands, you know, and food companies, co-manufacturers. So they're making ingredients for many, many different brands out of one facility. So we supply some of those co-manufacturers as well.
Yeah, the reason I ask is I'm just trying to get an idea of, for us to have a significant impact on what the landscape looks like as far as getting more diversity on the landscape, that kind of thing, how many companies we need like yours, you know what I'm saying, who are out there. And it just seems like there is so much room for that to diversify that supply chain out there, and for more of these kinds of businesses that can kind of create that incentive to have a more diverse landscape beyond the corn and soybean system.
We need a lot more, and diversity is good. So, you know, we can't be, you know, as much as I would love to, you know, have our revenues explode and be able to put these supply chains together for everybody, that's just not realistic. And, you know, we need stuff in region too. So we need to have, you know, production happening in different places that helps us with risk mitigation in our crop production. And brands, again, you know, brands and customers are going to move around. So we need more of this. This is one area where we're a small company, and, you know, I make most of the decisions. And if we need to go in a certain direction, we can change course and go in that direction. A lot of the larger ingredient companies who have a lot of infrastructure, that which is one thing we don't, and I look at that as an asset, no pun intended. I, you know, IT sort of taught me to be capital light, and farming is obviously the opposite of capital light. And of course, you need some infrastructure so that you have value add in the chain, but it allows us to work with processors who have specific focus for making certain ingredients, and they do that very well, and then we can feed those processors. So it helps them buy more volume. It helps with cost reductions by sending more volume to same facilities without building brand new ones. But we need more companies doing this. And frankly, you know, we need decommoditization in our agriculture system, right? We need to grow less commodity-based stuff and more high-value stuff, all while trying to balance what the consumer can pay, right? So, I mean, there is the other side of this, too, where not everybody can afford to eat good food right now. And so we don't want to, obviously, have all of our food costs go up and then nobody can eat nutritionists. Food. But I think generally I look at the farm completely different now. I think about profitability per acre, ROI per acre, not about yield. You know, everybody's trapped into, you know, I want to grow the most yield of my corn. And I think we're getting smarter now about looking at, you know what? I mean, if I don't put any inputs in or anything in my organic corn, I know I can grow 95 to 100 bushel corn without any inputs. And the ROI on that looks better sometimes than 250 bushel conventional corn.
We talked a little bit about how important the farmer-to-farmer networking and farmer-to-farmer education and kind of peer learning has been to the soil health movement. And you're talking about the Minnesota Soil Health Coalition. And I know LSB has a soil builders network that works in this region. And there's Practical Farmers of Iowa, Sustainable Farming Association. That's just been so key to that. I get a sense maybe for farmers who are taking that next step and trying to access some of these specialty markets or food grade markets, that farmer-to-farmer education is key there. Or maybe it's entrepreneur-to-entrepreneur education that maybe is key as in sharing that information as well.
I agree. I think this is a very unique time, right? Because I think about my technology background, and you know, one of the reasons people weren't interested in farms anymore is a lot of hard work and not a lot of technology. Now we almost have technology overload, like we can't keep up. And you know, I think that's a different podcast maybe on do we need all this technology, because some of the things on the farm were actually going old school backwards, right? Less technology in some areas. But data is really important, and data sharing is important. So now we have podcasts like this. We have you know, YouTube videos. We have different organizations with data. Mm-hmm. And all that is so much easier to access now so that we can learn and be better faster. But definitely that farmer-to-farmer communication is still, you know, critical. And in the food side, the food industry side, that's happening as well. You know, I'm on a panel or something almost every week about a different topic with a different group. So there's that collaboration and knowledge sharing happening in the food sector. And we're just going to see more and more of that on the farm ag side too.
For more on building soil health in a way that diversifies and fortifies a farm's financial bottom line, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 394 at landstewardshipproject.org. There, you'll find information on Land Stewardship Project meetings and workshops related to diversifying with the help of livestock and crops, such as small grains. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendahl, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.